This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. We're on BBS Radio. We usually are live and take phone calls, but this is a pre-recorded interview because our guest actually lives 9 hours away from California, so it would not have been convenient to have her on live. Our guest this week is Eva Bartlett. She's an independent writer and rights activist with extensive experience in Syria and in the Gaza Strip, where she lived a cumulative 3 years from late 2008 to early 2013. She documented the 2008, 2009, and 2012 Israeli war crimes and attacks on Gaza while riding in ambulances and reporting from hospitals. Since April 2014, she has visited Syria 6 times, including 2 months in the summer of 2016, and 1 month and one, I said once, it says once month, and 1 month in October, November 2016. Her early visits included interviewing residents of the old city of Homs, which, which had just been secured for militants, and visiting historic Ma'alula, I hope I pronounced that kind of right, after the Aramaic village had been liberated of militants. Eva Bartlett, welcome to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan.
Thank you very much, and thanks for subtly alerting me to a typo that I have to fix. Thanks a lot for having me on, Cindy.
Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for your courageous work. You know, it sounds like one of those old-time war correspondents that, you know, you see those black and white movies about. All of the things you've done, you've put yourself right in the middle of the action. So just tell my, that was a short bio, but obviously you've had extensive experience. Just expand on the bio a little bit and tell my listeners about yourself.
Yeah, I usually like to let people know, first of all, that I don't pretend to be an expert or an analyst. I'm just trying my best to convey the reality as I've seen it or as I've researched, whether it's in Palestine or in Syria or elsewhere. And I didn't study any of this stuff, much like many analysts that I have a lot of respect for, just kind of fell into it. American Canadian, was born in the States, grew up in Canada. I've done quite a bit of traveling before I became politically active and aware. I lived in South Korea teaching off my university debts because, unlike Syria, we don't have free education. And over time, I started kind of waking up and wanting to know more about certain issues in the world and, you know, falling for some of the Western propaganda initially, and, you know, starting to learn from other sources that I began to trust more and more what was really, in my opinion, happening in certain areas of the world. And then deciding eventually to go to Palestine to see for myself. And it's just been an, you know, upwards learning curve from there. So my objective, and I guess I should state this off, you know, at the front or at the start. My objective, you know, there, when you say things that counter corporate media or the dominant narrative, and if you get some notice, as I have recently, for something we can talk about, this UN panel, if you're doing something that rubs the corporate media, the establishment media, and NATO officials the wrong way, then you will be smeared, and I'm sure you're quite aware of this yourself.
Oh yeah.
So
that was one of my questions for you. So we might as well talk about it more, is that you really have taken a lot of heat for your alternative reporting. And I did, of course, take a lot of heat for presenting an alternative perspective about, you know, supporting war and things like that here in the United States. So just, like, you know, really expand on that, because you and particularly Vanessa Beely, who's been on the Soapbox and my other podcast, have, you know, you're presenting something that's completely contrary to what most people in the West, especially the United States, are getting in the propaganda media.
Yeah, and I think it's really, really difficult for people, like average people who, you know, are probably very good people, but are bombarded with scripted lying media. I think it's very difficult for them to digest a lot of what people like yourself or myself or Vanessa or Patrick or Syrians are saying, what's really going on. But yeah, the heat bit is basically in December, I went to New York, to the United Nations, and this was my initiative, and I'll state that clearly because some of this smear campaigning has alleged that this was arranged by the Syrian government, and it wasn't. It was only facilitated, but I requested it. And basically, I asked if I could do a report back on some of the things I've seen in Syria on 6 visits to the country. And the reason I thought to do that the U.S. Peace Council had done so in the summer after some of their delegation visited Syria. So I thought, well, right. I do have extensive experience. I've been writing and doing interviews. Why not do a panel? So I did do a panel shared with, I think it was 3 other people. And I spoke at, you know, for 20 or 25 minutes. And I really focused on media lies, on Aleppo, because I had been there 4 times. And I, you know, experienced at close proximity the terrorist bombing with gas canisters rigged up to be bombs fired at the hell cannons. And this continues, by the way. And I spoke at length about other issues. And the reason this got noticed was that in the question and answer period, an establishment journalist asked a question, and his intent was to discredit me. And because, you know, I was saying, and I will maintain, not every single journalist that works in corporate media lies, but a large number of them do, if not the vast majority. And I think there's various reasons, whether it's for career, whether they've sold out, whether they're being censored. But the fact is, when you look at certain issues like Syria, like Yemen, you will find, and Palestine, but certainly Syria, you will find some of the most atrocious lies, you know, we've seen.
Right.
And so I replied to him. He was basically saying, he was trying to say you're a blogger, or I can't remember his phrasing, but he's trying to imply that I wasn't worthy of believing. And he did so by saying, you know, we have sources on the ground. And he mentioned Aleppo. So I said, look, who are your sources on the ground? And I said, is it the White Helmets? Is it Rami Abdurrahman, the guy that runs the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights in England and hasn't been in Syria for over a decade and is funded by the West? Is it the Aleppo Media Center, which is funded by the West? You know, and I listed off, I can't remember offhand which ones exactly. And I basically just said, you don't have sources on the ground. And that's the whole point. Corporate media is manufacturing lies about Syria. They did it in Aleppo. We've seen it. Their lies have been proved to be lies after not just myself, but, you know, Vanessa Beely was on the ground in December when Aleppo was being liberated from Al-Qaeda and their terrorist affiliates. And other people who I know personally have gone to Aleppo and have been there recently. And they've corroborated what Syrians have been saying for years, what I was reporting, what Vanessa was reporting. And so that was my whole intent, was to say, look, you don't have sources. You may think you're doing well, but you are quoting people who are essentially getting their information from Al-Qaeda or from the U.S. State Department. Now, I will admit an error in the way I expressed myself. I wasn't entirely wrong, but I didn't articulate as well as I could have. And that was, I should not have said this particular girl is being, there's an instance of a girl that looks very similar who could have been used in staged videos. And we know they've staged videos. This is indisputable.
Right.
However, I cannot prove this girl was the same girl. It's highly probable. What I should have said is we have to question our sources, like the White Helmets especially, because they have $100 million in funding from the West. They work only with terrorists, and they have manufactured videos. So we have to question. That's how I could have been stronger. And I'm the first to admit fault. But this is a point just offhand, and I'll wrap this up, Cindy. But, you know, colleagues of mine, we've discussed, you know, well, Vanessa is under fire because she's done some really damning investigative research and reporting into these White Helmets and other, you know, nefarious characters that have been lauded as heroes in Syria, and they're terrorists, or they're supporting terrorists. And so she's being under character assassination for being with the U.S. Peace Council when they met President Assad.
Right.
So, you know, and it's, I was going to make a point, but I just have to say it's quite ironic that if either of us were to meet with, you know, former President Obama or Hillary Clinton, you know, people would probably say, oh, way to go. But she met with, in the context of a peace delegation, a legitimate president of a country that's being warred upon, and now she's being called an Assadist. And this is just a ridiculous attempt to discredit her.
Mm-hmm.
So I forgot what the point I was going to make. But anyway, essentially, what I was going to say is we have to be extremely careful, and we do try, and I do try, but I'm not perfect, and I will make errors, and I will admit them, although I wasn't entirely wrong in that assessment. And my second point, which Snopes, because Snopes is one of the sites that has written a smear campaign about me.
Right.
The second point about the Al-Quds hospital in Aleppo not being destroyed, I was absolutely right. And it's not because I'm a genius. It's because I had sources on the ground in Aleppo who were telling me, no, it hasn't been destroyed. And this whole myth that it had been destroyed came from Doctors Without Borders, a Médecins Sans Frontières, that said it had been hit, reducing it to rubble, was a quote from their report. So, you know, that was a second point I made to in the context of this UN panel, and that point was absolutely correct. Nonetheless, I you know, I can always articulate better, but the corporate media lies, and then they later issue a retraction, if at all. And that we can give examples of so many lies that you know, whether it's BBC, whether it's Qatar's Al Jazeera, whether it's Canadian CBC, which is rampant lying about Syria and Palestine, they never have to apologize for lying. They, we made a mistake. That photo wasn't Aleppo under Assad's barrel bombs. It was actually Iraq. Sorry. You know, so.
Well, you're right. They don't ever admit their mistakes because they are, I've had a lot extensive experience with the corporate media. They actually, like, plan these lies and smear campaigns, and they do, you know, they do it in a way that they don't like, state a fact. They just twist the facts and twist people's emotions, and so they're just, the corporate media is just absolutely twisted, and so you blog at RT, and you know, RT is under fire because they're, you know, Russian media or whatever. And you've actually said, if I'm in alignment with RT, it's because we're both telling the truth. And people who really look at media a lot know that RT covers things that the U.S. media doesn't cover, and more often than not, doesn't in a way that is correct.
Yeah, absolutely. I've met one of RT's brave war correspondents, Murad Gassiev. I met him in Aleppo. He's done amazing reporting. He's done what the prostitutes of New York Times or BBC or CBC that were in Aleppo, or the atrocious Channel 4, UK's Channel 4, they've blatantly lied and war propagandized, or they've obfuscated. Murad Gassiev works for RT. He also reported honestly. And he uses lexicon I wouldn't use. He says civil war. I don't call it a civil war. It's obviously not a civil war.
Right.
But that aside, I feel he's being incredibly honest. And yes, he works for RT. I don't actually blog for RT. And I have my own criticism.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I
No, it's not your fault. It's actually RT's fault. When they published a transcript of an interview I did with them, in which I said that point about us being in alignment because we're telling the truth, they were the ones that actually said Bartlett writes a blog for RT. However, I will say this. So Snopes is supposed to be a fact checker. I believe it was Snopes, certainly Channel 4, that cited that. Now, if they're actually a fact checker, then they would follow the link to the so-called blog, and they'd find that it's an opinion section, an op-ed section is what RT calls it. And there's over 70 contributors, so it's not a blog. And, you know, that makes a difference. People write op-eds for a variety of publications.
Isn't Snopes owned by people who contribute heavily to, like, you called her Hillary Clinton to the Democratic Party. So it's really in their interest to, it's funny, they're supposed to be fact checkers, but a lot of times we have to check their facts.
Oh, precisely. Yeah, I mean, when the Snopes article came out, I was in the process of giving some talks about Syria in the States, and then I came back and it was to Canada. It was Christmas, I visited my family, and then did some more talks in Canada. And I had my inbox and email and everything was flooded with messages, so I didn't have time, and a lot of time has passed, but I'm still going to go back and write a rebuttal to the smear campaign, the strawman arguments, the ridiculous claims in Snopes, in Channel 4, and maybe, you know, one of the other biggies. And anybody else who wants to do it, I'll just refer them back, because they're all going to copy each other, essentially, in their claims. And, you know, Snopes actually whitewashed for the White Helmets. And right. Snopes wrote some piece fact-checking the White Helmets, or claims about the White Helmets. I can't remember if it was in regard to Vanessa's articles. I think it was. And they just completely whitewash these terrorist supporters and terrorists. So, you know, they need to be outed. And there's a number of publications that have written about the questionable finance and support, and that they're not impartial.
Well, yeah, and it's amazing how the White Helmets, their documentary, I think, won the Academy Award and things like that. They're just serving the interest of the U.S. propaganda machine. They're serving the interests of U.S. foreign adventurism in their, like you said, whitewashing.
You know, I'd like to mention and applaud both Jimmy Dore, who I have to be honest, I wasn't aware of him before, but I've been made aware of his excellent satire and commentary. Well, not satire, but commentary.
Right.
He's a comedian, and he's done just amazing commentary with a lot of focus on Syria. And he's honest, and he's doing amazing, you know, videos or shows where he's totally outing the absurdity of the establishment media and you know, White House lies. And the other person I just noticed on Twitter the other day, yesterday maybe, Oliver Stone, movie director, you know, everybody knows Oliver Stone. He came out, I'm going to find the tweet for you if I can, it shouldn't be too far down, and he basically, I think we're probably going to discuss this in our discussion today, but he basically came and said the U.S. is lying about Assad or Syria using chemical weapons in Khan Sheikhoun.
We are going to talk about that.
And I can't applaud him enough, because he's got a major platform, and he's not being a coward. He's using his platform to make people think, and I really hope people will think, because it's an absurd accusation, and we'll get into why it's so absurd. So, yeah, I'm just really happy. Yeah, he said, who benefits from the gas attack blamed on Assad? Not Assad. It was clearly committed by the terrorists who were losing this war. So, bravo, Oliver Stone.
Yeah, good for him. And so before we get into those, I do want to talk about the so-called gas attack. I do want to talk about the bombing of the evacuees leaving Idlib, I believe. But let's talk about first your experiences when you've gone to Syria. Those really can't be refuted. Actually been there on the ground, and I think very few people who are reporting about these things incorrectly have actually been there. What tell us about the people, the culture, the support or lack of support for President Assad.
Yeah, and just before I get into it, I want to say one claim that's levied at me is that, well, she was only in so-called regime areas. I'd like to point out there's between 7 and 8 million internal refugees in Syria, and they're in government areas, and they're being housed by the government and by other associations. And these are people that have come from areas occupied by terrorists or where there's fighting. And these are people, maybe some of them are even, I mean, potentially supportive of the so-called revolution. And I can give an example. In Damascus, there's an area called Berzeh, and in Berzeh, the Syrian Trust for Development, which is an association, I believe it's, I don't know if it was founded, but it's run by the president's wife, Asma al-Assad, And it does. I visited this association, and it's not only in Berce, it's elsewhere. But in Berce, it's working with women that come from Ghouta, from east of Damascus. And Ghouta is a hotbed for terrorists. And it's teaching these women work skills so that they can support themselves. And there's a great chance that their husbands or their brothers, their male relatives, are in Ghouta and they're fighting against the government. So, I mean, just one example. In my travels, you know, for example, in Latakia, which is on the west side of Syria, or Tartus, which is on the coast as well, or Jeble, all these places I'm mentioning are government secured areas. But you will find, I think Latakia has over 1 million internal refugees, wow. And Tartus has something similar to that. Jeble is a very small city or town near the city of Latakia, and it also has... I think it was 100,000 internal refugees. And it's just notable because these are people, for example, people I met in Latakia in a market, they had fled Aleppo and they fled what they called terrorists. And I will always stress the fact that the majority of Syrians I've met do call them terrorists. They don't call them rebels. Or if they do so, they don't mean rebels. They do so in passing, but they certainly call them terrorists.
Right.
And these people had fled Aleppo. They'd left. In one case, the guy had a clothing factory. And a nice house. They left everything. The terrorists took over. In the other case, the guy had, I think it was a croissant shop that was very famous in Aleppo, and he fled and left everything and started over in Latakia. And there are many cases like this. In general, so the point I was trying to make just before getting more into my travels or experiences was that to discredit the voices that are in government areas is quite arrogant. It's a tactic to make their voices irrelevant and to instead, like Democracy Now, platform people who are outside of Syria and say Assad is killing his own people.
Right.
And, you know, even if they are in government areas, these areas are being attacked. Damascus, until this year, was, you know, when I was there in 2014 and 2015, I always stayed in the old city, with the exception of my first visit where I had to stay in a delegation hotel outside of the old city. I preferred to stay in the city because, well, it was cheaper and I'm self-funded.
Right.
And the other reason is it's more intimate. You get to encounter people more. But it was also closer to Jobar, which is east of Damascus. So it was being pounded by mortars, including where I was staying, very close by. So it was very dangerous. And there was one instance where I was outside the walls of the old city and a sniper from Jobar fired my way because it's less than a kilometer away. And he fired a few shots, near me and the people I was with. And, you know, thankfully, none of us were injured. But the other point is, Damascus is now slightly better, but it still gets mortared. And so people have suffered immensely in Damascus. In Homs, it's now secured. But there are areas like Al-Zahra, which I visited, that have suffered from suicide and car bombings. And, you know, people have been slaughtered and the media ignores them. And they report it like with a sectarian narrative. They say, oh, this is an Ali area, or this is a Shia area. Well, that's actually not true. It might be predominantly Shia or predominantly Alawi, but Al-Zahra, for example, had Christians from Sadad, a Christian area that fled the terrorists that were nearby. And it had Sunnis. I was told that a lot of the shop owners there are Sunnis. So, you know, this sectarianism is just, it's always something that's coming from outside, from Saudi Arabia and from our media and politicians, not from the Syrian society. And also, again, the point I was trying to make was, these areas, and also especially Aleppo, have been suffering. In Aleppo, just from the terrorist bombings, and I can't stress these hell cannons enough. You know, just as an aside, one of the rhetoric of the media is to talk about barrel bombs.
Right.
As if some sort of improvised bomb is somehow more deadly than what the U.S. has used on God knows how many countries, or what Israel used on Gaza, which
right.
I saw, the white phosphorus, or the dart bombs. But the media does not talk about what is actually a very deadly improvised bomb, these gas canister bombs. And these, the gas canister bombs, the snipings, the explosive bullets, all these attacks by terrorist factions that were occupying areas of Aleppo killed 11,000 civilians alone just in Aleppo. That's just civilians. And it's just from these attacks. And the attacks continue, even though Aleppo is liberated within the city now. There's still terrorists on the outskirts that are firing these hell cannon-fired gas canister bombs at civilians. So But just on the note before I forget, there's a young man, a friend now, named Pierre Lecorf, or Cor in French, C-O-R-F. He's in Aleppo. He's been there for, I think it's over a year. He's doing amazing reporting. If people want an honest source on the ground, he's thank God he's still alive, because he's been in some tight situations. And I don't mean from Assad. I mean from these terrorists.
Right.
One of my first, on my second trip to Syria, so the first time was with a peace delegation in April 2014, I went back in June after waiting over a month in Lebanon for a journalist visa to go to Syria. And finally I got it. And while I was in Lebanon, since you asked about support for Assad, in June 2014, there were the elections for the president of Syria. They were held some days earlier in Lebanon. So since I was still there, I went to the embassy and I saw masses of people, and I walked with them for many kilometers because the buses had clogged and cars had clogged the highway to get to the embassy. And it was like a festival. They were all decked out with Syrian flags. Many were wearing T-shirts with Assad or hats or had big posters, the cars, you know, decorated. They were singing. I think you've spent time in the Middle East, correct? And
yes.
You're probably aware of this, you know, the Dabke kind of mood, the fest mood where people are singing and dancing. They were actually doing that as they're waiting to go into the embassy to vote.
Wow.
And people spent all day there to get in. And the embassy was actually open for two full days, not one. It was supposed to only be open for one. They opened it a second day. And they kept it open till midnight, not 7 p.m., because of all the people that wanted to vote. People flew from around the world in countries like Canada, where we have closed the Syrian embassies.
Right.
People flew from countries where the embassy was closed to Damascus Airport to vote.
Wow.
So, I mean, the way the media portrayed the voting, they said it was a sham. They said people were forced. Well, in my experience, the people were not forced. And what I saw a week later in Homs, which the corporate media dubbed the capital of the revolution, Homs had been liberated in May, and I was there in June, and I saw people celebrating a week later, still celebrating the elections. And I also, I mean, aside from that, on a more somber note, I met this family, the Akhras family, who had stayed in the old city of Homs, even though many people had fled because the terrorists were occupying the old city, and they had been thieved, I believe it was over 40 times. I'd have to look at my notes, but some atrocious number. Like, the terrorists had come and stolen every last morcel of food. And this is an important point, because the terrorists were not supporting the people. The people do not support the terrorists. The terrorists abuse them. They in Aleppo, in other areas, Ghouta, they keep them as hostages.
Wow.
In a place called Madaya, last year there was a concentrated media campaign saying Assad was starving civilians in Madaya. The media was not talking about the villages we're going to be talking about today, Fu and Kafraya, which are in western Syria in Idlib. And Fu and Kafraya have been under full terrorist siege since March 2015 and under partial siege in years prior. And on top of that, they've been bombed on an almost daily basis, bombed and sniped, including children. And I've written extensively about this, and so has Vanessa and other people. And the media wasn't talking about Fu and Kafraya. They didn't care about those people actually starving. And the media also didn't talk about the Red Cross spokesperson who said just 2 months prior, because this campaign about Madaya started in January 2016. In October 2015, the Red Cross spokesperson had said, we took in enough food and supplies to last for 2 or 3 months, I believe it was. So somehow, 2 months later, everybody's starving. Logically, if the food arrived, then there's a reason people are starving and it's not Assad. And that reason came out to be that terrorists had taken the food and the aid and were stockpiling it and were selling it at, you know, gangster rates. And that's what they did in Aleppo.
Well, it's black market, right?
Exactly. So, you know, going to Homs for me back in June 2014, it was important because here was a family, and I met many families there, but here's this family that's talking about their experience, how they lost something like 30 pounds or 50 pounds. They were severely emaciated. If there hadn't been this deal to extract these terrorist factions out of Homs, then, you know, these people probably would have eventually died from starvation, or maybe they would have been killed. I don't know. When I was there, I also went to the church where formerly a Dutch priest had served, he was a mission or a priest there, and he'd been there for, I think it was close to 5 decades. And he was important too, because he's one of the voices that was contradicting the narrative that the early protests were unarmed. And he said, no, I've clearly seen armed protesters attacking unarmed security forces. And he made it clear he didn't support the government, but he's, you know, honestly saying what he saw. He was assassinated in April, I believe it was, 2014. And I met some of the people that him, his friends, and, you know, they told me he was assassinated because he didn't support the terrorist, and they just sat him down in the chair and shot him in the head.
I'm so sorry. Eva okay. Bartlett, we have to take a quick break. So this is The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. We are talking to Eva Bartlett, not Vanessa. It's early here in California. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Come, you masters of war.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. I've been a peace activist since 2004, when my son Casey was killed in Iraq. I've learned since then that achieving peace means more than just being anti-war. It encompasses being pro-environment and pro-equality for all people of all genders, religion, and ethnicities. Please join me at cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com with many other people who believe in working for a more peaceful and humane future.
This land is your
join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. We're speaking to Eva Bartlett. And Eva, recently, I don't know what happened first, if I asked you to be on or these attacks happened, but Trump said that, I think one day, maybe the same day or the day before, said that they weren't after regime change in Syria anymore. And then there was a poison gas attack that was blamed on the Syrian government, and then the U.S. response was to shoot 59 Tomahawk missiles to an airstrip in Syria. So talk about that attack and how the analysis is that it was not the Syrian government that did that. It could not have been sarin gas. So talk about what you know from on the ground and the analysis of that attack and then the U.S. response.
Sure. Well, I mean, as far as on the ground, what I can, and this isn't in reference to this particular attack, but I can say when I was in Aleppo, I did visit the Al-Razi State Hospital and also the University State Hospital a number of times to see victims of different terrorist attacks and also to talk with the hospital directors. And they told me, and also earlier a journalist that I know, Lama Khali in Aleppo, had sent me photos earlier of of people who actually had suffered some sort of gas attack. And these were both civilians and also rescuers from the Syrian Civil Defense. And I do not mean the White Helmets. And these people had been gassed by one of the terrorist factions. The directors in that hospital were very clear to say, we cannot confirm whether it was chlorine or mustard. It certainly looks like it. And they pointed out they couldn't confirm because of the criminal Western sanctions on Syria. They didn't have the appropriate equipment to analyze it. But back to this ridiculous latest attack. So yeah, the area in question, I could refer people to a number of reports, but there's, I think, a couple of approaches to looking at this. There's the approach that the MIT professor Theodore Postol took, and he analyzed the claims of the White Helmet or the White House, Freudian slip there, regarding this crater that was supposedly made by its so-called regime airstrike, that was supposedly the evidence that a chemical weapon attack had occurred. So there's a photo of a small crater. And he analyzed it, and the pipe that is left there, and he made a point, like, whether that pipe was placed. We don't know if it was this photo was staged or not, but he's saying, assuming it was not staged, and this is the evidence, part of the evidence the White House has presented in their very quickly compiled non-report, relying on social media, which they called open source media. Crazy. So in other words, relying on Twitter accounts for some of their evidence. But analyzing the photo, he was saying what it looks like it contains is a pipe that had been exploded, and the pipe might have had a chemical inside it. And he said also this was clearly not dropped by an airplane, but was placed. And I think this guy, I'll get his actual bio here because I'm working on an article. He's not somebody to write off as unknowledgeable. He actually formerly, another thing I want to make is he formerly examined the August 2013 accusations that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons in Eastern Ghouta. He and many people analyzed it, and the consensus was no, it had to have been the terrorists or the rebels, if you want to call them that. But with regards to this one, I'm just trying to find. I'll keep scrolling down and find his name. His report is on, I blogged it, but an interview was done with him by RT. Uh-huh. And he had at that time just done a very quick report because he didn't have a lot of time. But in his quick report, he noticed a lot of inconsistencies with the White House narrative. And he gave his professional assessment. Here we go. So Professor Theodore Postol. He said, I've located this crater using Google Earth. There's absolutely no evidence the crater was created by munition designed to disperse iron after it's dropped from an aircraft. And he gets into the details of what type of pipe it was and how it was probably staged. And he ends his initial report saying, what I can say for sure is what the country is now being told by the White House cannot be true. And the fact that this information has been provided in this format raises the most serious questions about the handling of our national security. He also, I'd like to note, back to the 2013 allegations. The issue of timing is really important because always before some major conference, whether it's Geneva talks or a conference, there was supposed to be a conference in Brussels, I think it was the day after this alleged chemical attack, some incident occurs. And in 2013, The timing was that it was about a year after Obama had given a speech in which he said, if Syria uses chemical weapons, this is a red line. They will have crossed, meaning intervention, meaning, you know, no-fly zone and destruction of the country like Libya. And so the issue of timing is important because, you know, here's where the logical part of analyzing these incidents comes into play. Logically, if you want to believe all the things about Assad, and if you want to believe there's a revolution in Syria, still logically, if Assad knows, if you want to believe he is this demon, as you know, he's been characterized as or caricatured as, nonetheless, he's not stupid. And as an aside, I don't believe these things, but if you want to, he's not stupid. And if you are the president of a nation that all the Western nations are saying, we're going to intervene if you do something like this, are you really going to do something like this? Their point is it as efficient as using a conventional weapon? Effective, I should say. Craig Murray, I believe he was a former British ambassador. He's brought up the point, it's not effective. Stephen Gowans, a great researcher and writer in Canada, you know, a lot of people have brought up the point using chlorine or using chemical weapon is not as effective as just using a conventional bomb. And then there's the logical point. Why would you do it when you know it's going to bring the wrath of the West upon you and it's going to bring intervention? Postal's report is really essential reading. And also people should look back at Seymour Hersh's many articles on sarin and who actually possessed sarin. And his investigative reports were published in the London Review of Books. And he has one entitled Who's Sarin and another entitled The Red Line and the Rat Line. And he basically looks at how sarin came to be in the possession of different so-called rebel factions and Turkey's involvement, you know, Hillary Clinton's involvement in funneling the weapons and sarin to, you know, via Turkey to these terrorists, Saudi Arabia's involvement. And the other point that people should be aware of is that there was a UN investigative team that looked into a prior accusation or allegation of chemical weapons usage in Khan al-Asil in 2013, March, I think it was. And Carla Del Ponte said, no, you know, all evidence points to the rebels having used it, not to the government. We see no evidence the government has used it. So based on prior examples, based on the fact, you know, this MIT professor Theodore Postel's report, based on logic and what you very clearly stated, you know, regime change was off the agenda of the White House. And then a day or two later, suddenly this attack occurs, you know, allegedly the Syrian government attacking its own people. And suddenly, you know, U.S. is illegally bombing Syria. The other point, a number of people, there's a website called A Closer Look on Syria, and they do very fine, detailed analysis of instances like this or massacres. And I believe it was there, because I've been reading a number of different reports, but I believe it was theirs that was pointing out, theirs or somebody else's, I'm sorry, I don't remember who, that was pointing out the photos and the videos that were presented, you know, by the White Helmets and other sources that are not credible, depict, you know, a lot of children, some of whom may have been drugged. And this is also something that was believed to have happened in Ghouta in 2013, that something like 250 civilians went missing from an area in, I want to say nearby in Idlib, perhaps in Latakia, a week or so prior to this alleged incident in April. And just that, you know, the location, the Western narrative, the White House narrative is that it was in, you know, there's an attack on a village. And the photos show bodies in an area that's quite remote. The attack apparently took place in an area where there wouldn't have been civilians, where it was known to be, you know, a terrorist hotbed. So there's many questions. I think people, if they don't have time to consider anything else, just consider the White House basically attacked Syria before they had any knowledge, whether or not, before they did any investigation. This itself is illegal. You know, if you want to believe that this occurred, then investigate it. But you can't just go and attack a country based on saying we have information.
Well, the interesting thing about the attack, was that it commenced when Trump was actually at dinner with the president of China, Xi Jinping. And, you know, it seems like it could have also been this warning to China. You know, it just brings a bunch of different U.S. foreign adventurism into place there. It's just, people just really need to know history, especially people here in the United States. Most of our wars are based on false flag incidents that might have happened, but they were twisted and lied about and used to get into these imperialist wars. And Oliver Stone, you mentioned him before, is very good at pointing these things out also. So it's just pitiful and pathetic how misinformed and miseducated the people in the United States and like you pointed out, Canada and Great Britain are so ill-informed about these things. So it's very important. And unfortunately, voices like yours are not heard, or they try to undermine you when you do speak the truth.
Yeah, I mean, and back to that point, I'm imperfect, and I might make an error in the way I'm speaking at some point. It's not intentional, and if I catch it, I will correct myself. But the media is manufacturing lies. And, you know, back to this alleged incident, here's another point, because I found a blog post I did some days ago. And there was video footage, or there's a still photo from video footage showing these white helmets actors supposedly rescuing sarin gas survivors. And right. I'm not a weapons expert, but I will quote from an article that was on Al Nazar news. And the article says, within seconds of exposure to sarin, the effects of the gas begins to target the muscle and nervous system. There's an almost immediate release of the bowels and the bladder. Vomiting is induced. And you cannot touch it with exposed skin. And this photo, the still, shows a white helmet actor with bare hands helping a sarin gas survivor. And in the background, another white helmet rescuer spraying water on a sarin. And these are not actions that a real rescuer would do. There's just a lot of questionable things with the you know, reported incident itself. Oh, and there's another excellent, I really encourage people to listen to interviews with Peter Ford, who was a former British ambassador in Syria. And he did an interview, I can't remember on which station, might have been BBC, but he says it's highly unlikely Syria was behind it. In my blog post, I also linked to Finian Cunningham, who's an excellent writer, and you know, he lays out a case. Rick Sterling also laid out a case for why it's highly improbable, and he mentions the timing. He mentions the theories that that people had been kidnapped and were being used. This is a theory; it could be true to stage the event. And he then lays out why it's most likely the militants or the terrorists themselves did it. So it's on, I don't know if I could send you links or not, Cindy, but I have this blog post which has a number of links that would help people who really want to understand what's happened to digest the information.
Well, of course, and when we post the show, everything that we've been talking about, we'd love to link to it. But also on the People Speak webpage, I believe all those things that you're talking about, we posted those already, so...
Oh, great.
Yeah, we'll make sure that...
Yeah, I neglected to mention Tabor Gonisian has a channel, a YouTube channel called Syriana Analysis, and he has an excellent 5-6 minute or so analysis. Syriana Analysis, and it's also in this blog post, so I can share it with you if you like. Sure. But he has one called False Flag Chemical Attack in Syria? And he lays out all the logical reasons and then, ends with that point, like, use your brain. You know, why would Assad do this now? Even if you want to believe whatever you want to believe, it's like asking somebody to come and shoot you in the head.
Well,
so
let's go on to the more recent event where some evacuees were leaving Idlib province on a bus, and it had been something that the Syrian government negotiated with the terrorists to let some people leave. And that bus was bombed, and of course some Western media are blaming Assad for bombing the bus, but again, why would he bomb the bus if they negotiated for those evacuees to be released? So, and I believe Vanessa was able to interview some people, although I haven't been able to watch the coverage of that.
Yeah, Vanessa has an article out now on 21st Century Wire called Rashidine Massacre, Children Lured to Their Slaughter by NATO State Terrorists. So basically, and you're right, she did, because she's in Syria now, and she was with a delegation in Aleppo, which went to a center which received the survivors of this attack on civilians. And so she says, now we've seen differing numbers of how many people were actually killed. her source, who I know in Aleppo, is saying 200 civilians, including 116 children, were killed in these terrorist attacks. And yet this is not newsworthy, or the news is spinning it as Assad did it, which is beyond absurd. It occurred as these civilians were transiting from Kafayan Fua, the villages I mentioned earlier, villages that have been suffering immensely. And the exact number of buses, I'd have to scroll through her article. I don't remember offhand, but it was a convoy of buses.
Okay.
And it wasn't, you know, this is, it's so sadistic. It wasn't only just attacked by either suicide bomb or explosive detonation, as Vanessa writes. It wasn't only attacked, but they, her article outlines how the people were kept captive for something, I think it was a day. And the terrorists were taunting the people as they went on the convoy. They were supposed to be going towards Aleppo. And eventually they took the children out, took a number of children out of the bus. I haven't read her article yet, so I don't want to quote from it. But essentially, there are videos showing them throwing bags of chips on the ground, potato chips, and the children running to get the chips. You know, they haven't seen something like this in years. And a number of children being amassed and then them exploding a bomb and murdering these kids.
Oh, my God.
It's beyond sadistic. So and they, you know, this is the thing. They love to document their own war crimes, and they gleefully post it on their social media accounts that somehow are still up and, you know, never get taken down in spite of their violent nature. And so this is documented. And then, of course, Vanessa has the testimonies, and also Janice Kortkamp, who's in Syria right now, an American citizen, has testimonies, and other people that are on the delegation have the testimonies of these survivors talking about how their children were taken away from them, you know, tricked or lured with potato chips, bombed. And there's something like 200 children who are missing. And, you know, the next time there's a chemical weapons allegation, I bet some of these children will turn up in the videos.
And because these are the forces that the United States is allying with in their policy of regime change in Syria, which is monstrous. And this happened when Obama was president, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. This isn't something that was started by Trump. And I'd like to just mention that, because so many people here in the U.S., gave Obama a free pass on all these things. And so Trump is just piggybacking on the policy of the Obama administration and the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the U.S., I mean, they're also, in addition to lying about Assad or the Syrian army, actually, I want to make that point. The Syrian army, the Western media calls them Assad's forces. You know, Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, who likes to tweet, you know, photos and videos that are not what he says they are. Like, for example, he tweeted a video of Shajai in eastern Gaza, and he said it was Aleppo under Assad's barrel bombs. Clearly lying. Clearly knew who was lying. Didn't matter. But they like to call the Syrian Arab army Assad's forces. And, you know, it's intentionally misleading to people, because people who don't know much about Syria, haven't been there, will have this, you know, subconscious, subliminal image of this massive group of menacing people that are slaughtering civilians. It couldn't be the more opposite. These are people, you know, of all faiths, all ages. And there are women in the army. I don't know the numbers. But if you go there, you will see volunteers who are in the National Defense Forces, or volunteers that in their, you know, small towns or villages that are like Malula. Malula is a perfect example. It's one of the most ancient Christian villages. And it was occupied by terrorists from the Free Syrian Army, from Jabhat al-Nusra and other terrorists for 8 months, from September 2013 to April 2014. And yes, the Syrian army and Hezbollah allies were, you know, liberated it, but not on their own. There were also locals from Malula that were not part of the army that took up arms to defend themselves and defend their villages. But, you know, amongst, if you go to Syria, you will see people who are in their 50s or 60s, that you can see men with, you know, old looking men serving in the army. And it's not because Assad's paying them, and it's not because Assad's forcing them. It's because they want to defend their country.
Well, defend their communities and defend their families, and, you know, absolutely. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, but this massacre of people in from Fu and Kafai, it's completely obscene because it is just a week or so after, well, maybe 2 weeks after the alleged attacks, in which people may or may not have died. I mean, people did die. We don't know the numbers of the alleged chemical attacks. And it's almost, 99% sure that it was done by terrorists to stage this, as they've done before. They've committed or staged so many massacres that don't get reported in corporate media. Professor Tim Anderson has written about them. Shermin Nirwani has written about them. Other, honest journalists or writers have written about them, but corporate media won't. And so this obscene massacre, we don't expect it to be fairly covered, or we don't expect Trump or his wife or daughter or whomever to cry or care. But it is important that people at least know it happened. And so Vanessa's article, I'm sure she's going to be coming out with more, and hopefully Janice will as well. I would really encourage people to look at that because these are civilians. They have been starved. And Vanessa and I met people from Fu and Kafraya who there was one evacuation in December 2015, I think it was. And last summer, we were both in Syria at the same time. And so we met with these people, and they're living hell in Fu and Kafraya. They are deprived of food. They're deprived in the winter of fuel for cooking food or for keeping warm. They're deprived of medicines. People that have treatable diseases are not getting treatment. And I wrote at one point last year about two boys, ages 4 and 6, Laith and Muhammad, that were shot in the head and in the neck by a sniper, by one of the Western allied terrorists. And
Eva,
these boys were...
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry, because I'd like to hear more. But you said you were self-funded. So can you tell my listeners how they can support you in your very important work?
Thank you. Right now, I'm still writing on my old blog, which I began when I was living in Gaza. So it's called ingaza.wordpress.com. I will change that to a proper website soon. I've been saying that for months. And there's a PayPal. So if people want to support, they can support by PayPal. People in Canada could do a bank transfer, I suppose. Or just sharing our articles is also supportive. So
that link on the blog. And thank you so much, Eva, for Eva Bartlett, for taking your time to be on The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. And thank you for your courage. And, hang in there with these attacks. I can tell you that you'll look back on them and you'll just shake your head, because you know that you're being vindicated. The truth will, I don't want to say it'll set you free, but the vindication of your work, will be your reward, I guess. And I really hope that people support your good work.
Thank you. And thank you very much for that. And, at this point, I don't care what people call me, because I know I'm telling the truth.
Absolutely.
And my objective is to tell the truth, and I'm honoring my word to Syrians. So people can say what they will. Hopefully they will change their mind, not because of me, but because it's Syrian lives at stake. So thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you so much. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The People Speak, and our guest has been Eva Bartlett. So see you next week. Peace out for now.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.